Anyways, the word that I use, like my first word that I always use. Well, I have swap between two. I usually use stale or stain.
Oh yeah, I use stain.
Yeah. You use stain too?
I often.
It's such a good one.
My two are stain and rogue.
Rogue. Oh. Yeah. I mean, rogue has a lot of vowels.
Yeah. But yeah. If I do those two, then I have the five main vowels in.
Oh, you okay? You do those right after each other. Yeah, yeah. I haven't really employed that strategy very often. Like, I don't have two words for that strategy. There have been times when I've thought about using that strategy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's
I haven't. I'm sure that there's a rabbit hole of forums and blog posts about,
and YouTube videos, and
yeah, but whether certainly about those tactics, but also whether or not you're supposed to be using them, because Lisa was talking about how someone at work got mad at her just because Lisa uses the same first word for every puzzle. Like, she thought that was kind of breaking some rule of the game. But Lisa and I tend to play it very tactically, and it's like we want to solve it, and we do.
You want to solve it, and you're not dumb. Yeah. Just because you understand how the alphabet works doesn't mean you should like lower your intelligence to like. Yeah. I don't know.
The only way that it implicit that the game implicitly that the game implies that that's not a fair strategy is that if you put it in hard mode, you're not allowed to make guesses that violate some part of the word that has been previously revealed. So,
right. That's fair. I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which honestly,
that's just hard mode.
That's kind of a pain in the rear, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though I'm not using two first words, mm-hmm. and today I wouldn't have had to use two first words because when I put in stale, I got S and L in the correct places and T and E in the non-correct places.
Right.
So if you can't try a word that you know, just to like, often what happens is I'm not quite sure where the non-correctly positioned letters are supposed to go. So I just think up a word that has those letters in a different position. And it may also include a letter that I know is already excluded, but it just helps me narrow it down. Right.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I would feel like I had my arm tied behind my back if I wasn't allowed to use that strategy.
Again, maybe this word already exists or this phrase already exists because I know a lot has been written about Wordle, but Lisa and I call those guesses discovery guesses. You know you're violating an existing, or sorry, you know that
an
you're
existing clue.
Yeah, exactly. But you need to perform some discovery, and so you put it in to see what comes out. Yeah, but you don't know about Wordle 2?
No, what is Wordle 2?
Like, Wordle 2 is like the gym where I go in to do my reps so that I can just crush Wordle.
What? How is it structured differently?
Well, Wordle
2. Oh, you can just do it all day long or something? Doesn't meet out your get. It doesn't meet out puzzles one a day or something.
Well, I mean, if you want to do it all day long, there's Wordle Archive, and there you can go through all of the archives. And then once you've exhausted the archives, you can go to a random generated Wordle that you can do as quickly as possible.
Oh, and does it use the same word list? It must. Yeah, they probably just grab the word list from the JavaScript from the website.
That's a good question. I don't know how transparent the word list is, especially since the New York Times took possession, but.
Well, at least before they took possession, it was totally public.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But Wordle 2 is, there's two puzzles a day. So at midnight and noon, there's new words. It's six letters long.
The look on my face, listeners, is like very annoyed.
But, and I'm not saying,
is it by a different author? Is it owned by the New York Times? Is the New York Times now suing them or what?
I have no idea. I can tell you that the domain is not New York Times the way that Wordle is since its acquisition. But
interesting.
And I didn't say it's six letters long just to try and impress you. but like I
know when I said I didn't think that you did. I thought that you were just explaining it to me, but then I was immediately sort of like annoyed because that's not the, I mean, the point of the puzzle. I don't know. It just feels, I don't know, that changes, that fundamentally changes the puzzle, I feel like.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot more, linguistic and lexicographic subtleties to a six-letter word. I'm just kidding. But when I say I treat it as my gym to work out for real, it's like you, I kind of like try new stuff and do a lot of experimentation there and right. try not to worry about the stats, just like, you know, like a pure
Speaking of which, what are your Wordle stats like? I want to see. You should share them with me at some point if you ever go on. Oh, like maybe sure. you can post them on our Instagram.
Sure, yeah. I can do that. Well, anyway, so there's Wordle. There's Wordle 2, but if you're really serious, you play Quartle.
What's Quartle?
Quartle is 4 simultaneous Wordle games. You get more than the is it 6 guesses in Wordle? I wouldn't know because I never used the 6th guess, but I'm just kidding. My stats will tell you that's not true. With Quartle, you get more than the 6 guesses, but you're playing four Wordle puzzles simultaneously. So like right. your one guess gets input into 4 different puzzles simultaneously.
Oh, interesting.
And then you have 9 or 10 guesses to try and solve all 4 of the 5 word puzzles.
Oh yeah. That sounds like a Wordle gym. Actually, yeah. that sounds like that reminds me of like in the Queen's Gambit when she's like playing against a whole room full of chess champions.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
And I will also say that the solutions to the Quartle puzzles tend to be much more obscure than the Wordle ones. Like there's obscure words in Wordle, but I've never been like, is that even a word? When I find a solution.
The Wordle dictionary is quite like, you know, most of them are pretty well-known words.
Yeah. But Quartle, there's legitimately been words that I have like, because it tells you before you submit the guess whether or not it's in the dictionary, there have been words that I've been like, I had to look up afterwards. I said, I like junto. You ever heard of the word junto?
No fair.
Yeah.
Never heard of it.
But there it is.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're 2 chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Do we have some follow-up tonight? Yes, we have follow-up.
I had one bit of follow-up that I don't know if I have all of the information to fully follow up on. But Our last conversation, we were talking about cooking school, and a small part of that conversation was the difference between doing apprenticeship and doing a full-time culinary arts program.
Right.
Which we talked about that briefly, but I didn't, and talked about the broad layouts of those two programs. Mm-hmm. Didn't really delve into the difference and why someone might choose one over the other. But this, over the last 2 weeks, NAIT, like Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, announced that they were suspending their apprentice cook program.
Right.
Which I haven't even fully thought about all of the ramifications and fallout from that. But
so, yeah, they're suspending the apprenticeship program, which, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, would be my favorite program recommend to people. So I find that kind of unfortunate. Do you know, like, is it, Yeah. Do you have any information about like whether it's like permanent or how, like, because is like, isn't it sort of like shouldn't apprentice cooks in the province have access to that schooling? Like, isn't there kind of provincial or federal mandate to provide that schooling if they have a certification around it?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, even though I work there, being relatively new to it, I don't understand all of the issues surrounding it. There's a lot to do with funding and, say like the funding that, NAIT gets from the province, and also the amount, apprentices pay in tuition and stuff like that. But yeah, right. I think at its heart, it was presented to staff as a financial decision, like that as it currently exists, the apprentice cook program was not financially sustainable. In terms of, oh, and sorry, it is not, it's, it has not been terminated or canceled. It's been suspended. So I think that gives them, I think they said a year to review it and try and make changes to make it more sustainable. I don't know.
So they may reassess like what the fee structure is, or they may try to find a way to get more funding for it or something like that. And
exactly. Right. I don't think, I mean, not to get political shale, like I'm not making a flippant statement when I say that the provincial government in Alberta right now is like really, really severely cutting back the funding that they provide to post-secondary education in the province.
Right.
So I don't think that's the tact that NAIT is going to be taking to try and get more funding from the government. But, and then in terms of, its accessibility, that's a very good point. There might be others, but I know that as far as I know, SAIT, so in Calgary, SAIT and Red Deer College, they both have the apprentice cook program still. So it is theoretically accessible to Albertans.
Still accessible in the province, right?
It does. I mean, obviously, like if you live in Edmonton or Fort Mac and you have to relocate.
Go to Calgary or Red Deer to take the apprenticeship program, it's basically not really worth it because, I guess most people, exactly.
It depends whatever. Maybe they have an uncle in Red Deer or something, but that they can stay with, I mean. But and the other thing that I didn't really think about during our last conversation and only looked into after I learned that this program was being canceled in Edmonton. Apprenticeship is by far more affordable than a full-time culinary arts program.
Yeah.
Like a lot.
Not only in terms of, not only in terms of tuition, but also in terms of the amount of time invested. Like if you count your time as a commodity, which, if you're taking school to get employment, then I think that, that's a pretty good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. The time investment is also, the financial investment for tuition is less and the time investment is less. So, if you're trying to fast track your cook's education, that's, an option that I guess you won't have really in Edmonton anymore. It's too bad.
Yeah. It's pretty, I don't understand all of the ins and outs and nuances and stuff, but it seems crazy to me that you want to be a cook in Edmonton, like a city of a million people, and you can't take the apprenticeship training in this city anymore. But
yeah. Well, hopefully they'll find a way to resuscitate it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I imagine that they probably will. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get political either, but hopefully somebody looks at that and is like, this is a bad situation and that, and draws the link between the cutting of educational funding and having to cancel, a pretty important program for the industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll keep you posted.
Anyways, that's the sad part.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the happy part.
What's that?
In our last episode, we talked about mandolins.
Yes.
And we got a little bit of feedback about mandolins, and we wanted to provide a little bit of feedback about mandolins, I guess. So
okay.
Did you, are we on the same page that like calling a French mandolin is a legitimate thing to call it now? Or
I think that, oh, shit. I think
oh,
that,
no? Okay. That's
like
fair.
that is the language that's used online. What I was trying to say that I don't think came across very clearly is that design wise, I don't think there's that much different between the two styles.
No, I agree.
I know.
I mean, they both do the same thing, and they both use the same basic engineering design to do it. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's a flat plane with a blade sticking up above it.
Yes.
Like, any way you look at it.
And it seems silly to me that it just doesn't, it's not a clear delineation. Like, clearly you could make something that had the exact same specs as a Ben Reiner Japanese mandolin, but you can make it out of stainless steel. And you could put the grooved blade on it and stuff like that. It just like seems kind of arbitrary that one is called French and one is called Japanese. But anyways, that's definitely how they, like, if you look online, all those terrible blogs that try and teach you everything you need to know about cooking and mandolins, they'll say this is a Japanese one, this is a French one. What am I being, sorry, I'm not trying to be belligerent.
So
I just,
now
like,
I'm a terrible blog.
No, you're not a terrible blog. I mean, I looked into it afterwards because you made it seem like it was something that was very obvious. So yes, that is how it's spelled out online, is that like,
right.
However,
I mean, like, I knew them as that basically before the internet existed, but you know,
before 1979, yeah, just kidding. To me, a French mandolin has a stand and a Japanese mandolin doesn't, but like, obviously you could make a Japanese style mandolin that has a stand. And when I look at old,
you could probably 3D print a stand for your Ben Reiner if you wanted to.
Totally, you could 3D print a Ben Reiner probably.
You could actually probably.
Even the way that they're adjusted, just because they both have terrible adjustment like mechanisms, so which is why they're so hard to control precisely. But anyways, sorry, what was the initial question?
I don't know.
Do I?
Oh, well, I was just asking you if we agree that they should be called Japanese and French mandolins. And I guess that I have the answer to my question.
We're both definitely on the same page about what is being referred to when we say French or Japanese mandolin.
So yeah, also when we were talking about it, I think like I was trying to describe to you how like the blade on a Japanese mandolin is on an angle compared to what it is like on a French mandolin. And I felt like you weren't really understanding what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to find out if you now understand what I was saying about the blade being on an angle. Like it's angled from like one lateral side of the mandolin down to, or like, you know, I guess it depends on which side you start on, but yeah, it's like, it starts higher on one side and goes down lower on the other side. And I think that means that when the food is coming into contact with the blade, it contacts the blade more gradually, instead of all at once. Like, whereas on a French mandolin, the blade goes straight across the width of the mandolin, and so you're hitting it with the flat side of the food, like the whole blade all at once. And I feel like that's a benefit that the Japanese mandolin has in terms of like it, I don't know, feeling like it cuts food smoother or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the time, I didn't. At the time, I think my understanding was that you meant that the blade itself was angled up from the cutting plane.
Right, which but it may mean, be slightly.
But you mean that, so like on a French mandolin, the direction that you're pushing the food, the edge of the blade is exactly perpendicular to your pushing motion, whereas on the Japanese mandolin, it's at something like a 45-degree angle to your pushing motion, and I'm sure that... Yeah,
I mean,
sure
I don't really know how much of a difference it makes, but I don't know. Like in my experience using both, that seems to be one of the things that feels like it makes a difference to me.
Well, I think it's analogous to like when you're chopping veg, like doing a straight up and down chop motion versus like rocking your knife forward and forward right, and back, so it's
coming
and up
down,
and down
at through the food, like yeah, at an angle.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I think it's similar. Yeah. So that, and then we also got some feedback from Judy about mandolins, about the adjustment mechanism, and she, what did she say? Like she said that, it, you know, like if you Google mandolins, you get a lot of different adjustment mechanisms. Mm-hmm. I think like, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, there are a lot of mandolins out there, but none of them, like most of them, the vast majority are not really a part of the conversation because they're not well built and they don't have good blades that you can remove and sharpen. Mm-hmm. And they... I mean, some of them may have reasonably good adjustment mechanisms. Some of them may even have better adjustment mechanisms. I don't know. I haven't tried them all. But, you know, for the most part, most of the, like, consumer-grade mandolins that I've tried, the plastic construction is usually not as strong or, like, as inflexible as a Ben Reiner. And then the blades are usually made out of, like, a stamped piece of, like, thin stainless steel. Mm-hmm. And the edge is sharpened, but like the blade is basically as thin as like, you know, like the whole blade is just a thin piece of steel with a sharpened edge. Whereas mm-hmm. like the edge on like a real professional French mandolin or the blade on a Ben Reiner, like it's a thick piece of hard steel, like tempered steel. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes a huge difference. And like, I don't like... For professional use or even for use in my home kitchen, like I just feel like, you know, like I would go through an OXO Good Grips a week or something, you know, right. like the yeah. blade would get yeah. so dull. And I, you know, they say that there's a way to remove it and sharpen it, but like I just feel like the blade would get so wavy and mm-hmm. so beat up so quickly that it's just not even really worth the effort, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you never know.
I think, and specifically with the width adjustment, like I was talking about there being a measured gradient where you could set a dial and know that you're slicing at a 16th of an inch or so.
Right, right.
And in, again, it, like you said, in theory, that does exist and you can easily search products that claim to have that ability. But when I look at the construction and the dial, like the width dial mechanisms for those, it just doesn't seem like it has anything like the precision and more importantly the durability of something like a meat slicer where it's like
right yeah, yeah you, exactly
you turn this dial to this setting and
to
you know
1 millimeter and you're gonna get a 1 millimeter slice every yeah. single time. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And like the other thing about and this even happens with the Ben Reiner, even though it's made out of pretty thick hard plastic, like if you're trying to slice things like paper thin, like see-through kind of thin, like if that's the goal, and oftentimes when you're using mandolin, like that's the only, a mandolin is kind of the only way to get that kind of slice. Mm-hmm. Well,
consistently,
I'm sure people have way better knife skills than I do or something, right, but you know, for me, you know, that's definitely the easiest way to get consistent slices that are like paper thin like that. Mm-hmm. But like just like a slightly different, even on a well-constructed mandolin, like even a slightly different amount of pressure will give you a different thickness mm-hmm. when you're trying to cut things that thin yeah. or like a slightly different amount of pressure on one side of the product that you're trying to slice versus on the other will give you like an uneven slice to the extent that like you don't get a whole nice slice. You get like, you know, half of a paper thin slice and then it just tapers off to nothing or something. Right. And so you have to be like, you know, even with a well-constructed mandolin, you have to be pretty careful, like that you put the same amount of pressure on the product every time you make a slice and that you put the same amount of pressure like on the front and the back to make sure that you get even slices and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like most of the OXO or no name Amazon available like home mandolins, I just don't feel like you would be able to get anything close to something that's consistent trying to slice things that thin.
Right.
I mean, I may be wrong. Like I said, I haven't tried them all, but.
And in a professional setting, like I can't remember if I said this explicitly last conversation, but like, yeah, the meat slicer kind of solves right. all of those problems for you.
All except, of that problem. Yeah, yeah.
Except for the one instance where you want to use the grooved blade to make gaufrette potatoes. That was the only, case I had where I was like, oh, I wonder if there's a special tool we could develop that would solve that problem. But,
oh, man. Yeah. Okay. Alan, you win. You're right. There's no sense. If you have a meat slicer, you don't need a mandolin except for a French mandolin. And that's only if you need to make gaufrettes.
Thus rendering the Japanese mandolin
completely useless
redundant at
from
least
here until the end of time. Oh, speaking of which, have you ever used one of those like sheeters? It's like, it's also made out of plastic and it's similar construction to like a Benriner. In fact, I think Benriner makes one.
Okay.
And you put, it's sort of like, oh, you know what a veggetti is?
No. I don't think so.
It's like a spiral. Oh, a spiralizer. Do you know what a spiralizer is?
Yeah, I think so.
It like makes noodles out of vegetables
yeah.
or something.
Yeah. Yes.
You turn
yes.
you turn a handle and it turns vegetables and it just like takes off, like it cuts yep. them into noodle slices.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a similar tool that's like a sheeter and you can put like, you know, a potato or a carrot or a sweet potato or whatever, and you can adjust the thickness of the sheet that you want mm-hmm. and you like turn, you put it in between like two posts that turn mm-hmm. and you can like make these big long sheets like a lasagna noodle, but like
right.
out of
okay,
potato
I can picture
or something.
It, yeah. Yeah.
Those things are awesome. I wish I had one of those.
Yeah.
A sheeter. They're pricey though.
It's like a, what is it like? It's like a lathe almost, only your.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a vegetable lathe.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
And what was the word that you used for the spiralizer?
Veggetti.
A veggetti. Is that yeah. a brand name?
I think it is, yeah.
Sounds like a kind of pasta.
That was how I heard about it for the first time, huh. was as people, or I think I heard about it for the first time on Cooking Issues, Dave Arnold's podcast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for like months, they were talking about stuff that they were doing with their veggetti. And I was like, oh, what is that? And then I looked it up and yeah, otherwise known as a spiralizer.
Spiralizer. The way that I was introduced to the spiralizing mandolin, we called it a Chinese mandolin. And I don't know if that was just like a joke because we had Japanese mandolins and this one was different, so it's a Chinese one, or if it actually had some other, like if it was made by a Chinese company. I have no idea, but that's
yeah,
how
I don't know either. I think I have heard it referred to as that as well.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't really know if it's culturally insensitive to call it that, but probably, I don't know.
I have no idea. I'm definitely going to call it a veggetti going forward.
Yeah, that's a way better name. It's even better than spiralizer, if you ask me.
Spiralizer is pretty cool. It sounds futuristic.
Yeah, it does.
So does veggetti, though. I mean, like...
It sounds like a word that you haven't really heard of before, but that sounds like it should be a word or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's move on to topics, Alan. No more follow-up, right?
Not for me, no.
Me neither. Yeah, and we do have a topic tonight. You are kind of in charge of our topic, so yeah. Do you want to introduce it?
Well, it's the
I'm just along for the ride.
It's the second installment in our ongoing series entitled Amateur
Menu Historian Corner.
Hey, I'm in charge. No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry.
Amateur. It's a mouthful. It took me Amateur Menu Historian Corner. So,
yeah, the fact that it's a mouthful is what makes it a great title.
It's kind of like those really cheesy segments they do on late night shows. I don't know if they still do it because I haven't watched late night TV.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Years, but...
It sounds like a Letterman bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we've only done one before, but the premise is that I have rustled up an old menu, which I read to you without any kind of context given. And then you...
I already have some context. I already have a context clue.
I slipped some
you.
To
slipped
your,
me a yeah. clue already when you said rustled.
It's not going to... Oh. And then you are left to just flounder and guess as to what is going on. I'm just kidding. You
yeah,
give
I got to try and dig myself out of the hole of ignorance.
You give a reaction and maybe guesses as to what's going on.
Totally.
And we play it by ear and then there's a reveal. Is that how?
Hopefully there's a grand reveal and it's very dramatic. Hopefully there's like an aha moment where I'm like, oh, right. I'm such a dummy.
No, I don't.
That's what we're. Yeah.
No, I don't think that's the point. And this one,
well, I mean, yeah, I don't think the point is to make me look stupid, but I think it's entertaining to like
make you look stupid.
I feel like it's entertaining for other people for me to be in the dark and, you know, make stupid suppositions.
So this one is quite a bit different than the last. And it's possible that because the menu itself is like the wording is much more obscure and was less words.
Really?
So I'm just going to read it and we'll just have to figure it out as we go.
Okay.
And actually, just full disclosure, this is going to be the menu is abridged. So there's actually originally 14 courses, but we're only going to discuss 10 of them tonight.
Oh, okay.
But I'm just going to read it to
you. I assume there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
not just because it's a long menu, but
partly because of that, and also just because of the information that I was able to find or not find on each of the dishes. Okay. So here's a menu, Shale. Do you want to hear it?
Okay. Yeah, let's blast through the whole thing and then we'll start making guesses.
10 courses. Here they are. 1, intuitive antipasto. 2,
okay,
total rice with wine and beer.
Okay.
3, aero food, tactile with sounds and smells.
Okay. Aero food.
Yeah.
Tactile with sounds and smells.
Yeah. 5, ultra virile. Sorry, 4, ultra virile.
That's the name of the course.
That's
ultra virile.
Yeah. That's how it was written on the menu, as far as I know. Course 4, ultra virile.
Okay.
Course 5, sculpted meat.
Yeah, it reminds me of a certain berserker I know.
That was fat.
I know. It's not actually meat fat either, but back in the day, it used to be tallow. That's what they used to sculpt.
Yeah. Course 6 is called Italian Sea.
Okay.
Course 7, I've seen described as both chicken fiat, but also steel chicken.
Chicken fiat, steel chicken. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Course 8 is called Equator and North Pole.
Okay.
We're almost done. Course 9 is called Elasticake. And
it's a great name for a dish.
It's a great name for a dish, yeah. Course 10 is called Network in the Sky.
What?
That, as far as I know, that is how the menu was written for this dinner. That's the language that appeared on the menu.
Okay. Well, man, I am very confused. I guess I'm kind of like, when we say that this is amateur menu historian corner, I mean, I think when I think history, I'm thinking about something that happened quite a while ago.
Mm.
But this menu sounds to me like very modernist. The names of the dishes to me sound modernist,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm,
avant-garde at the very least.
That's a good word, yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm very confused because I want, like, you know, immediately, like right off the top of my head, I'm thinking like, oh, this is like a Wiley Dufresne menu from WD-50 or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's the first thing that springs to mind. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, and I'm sure that there are like historical meals that happened there and meals that I think probably could be considered historical, maybe some of their first services or some of their last services or something like that. But I don't know. Something tells me that that's not what we're dealing with here just because of the context. So
do you want to know the date, or is that
If you think that that's too big of a clue right off the bat, then not necessarily, but yeah, kind of.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's like this menu, and it is from a restaurant. So this menu, it wasn't just a weird one-off, like this is from a real restaurant. But this okay. was the first menu that was served at a restaurant that opened on March 8th in 1931.
Holy, holy smokes. 1931.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Wow, that's fascinating.
But that
my mind's kind of blown right now.
Yeah, it's pretty so yeah, it is in that regard, in the temporal meaning, like yeah, it's definitely historical. Or not, yeah, not even though like you said it sounds modernist, it's not, it's certainly not contemporary.
Yeah.
And yeah, not part of the modernist movement as we understand it. But that being said, like just the language is so tierce. Like it's hard for you to have any,
there's not a lot of context.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's like one or two word dish names and stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. But what was the name of the 10th course?
Network in the Sky.
Yeah, man. Like what is with that? What does that mean in the context of something that would like of something from 1931, like what does that mean in 1931? Like I get like
the good
telegraph.
Oh, well, no, that's like, a yeah, no, that's a good yeah. Like definitely like in 1931 modernism like had a different meaning than it does to us now, obviously, but I think that
yeah
that,
for sure, and futurism was like a lot different in 1931, and yeah
luckily I with the last menu that we discussed, we were kind of more familiar with the language that it was using, but then had a lot to guess about beyond that. But for right. this menu, for the 10 items or the 10 offerings that I've listed, actually have something like a recipe for each of them.
Oh,
or at
really?
Least a description. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
So
is it, would like the description have been included on the menu as like subtext or
no? Basically
the menu was just presented like with that text
as far as I know. Yeah, but the people who were making the dishes for this restaurant wrote a cookbook. So they,
okay.
And their recipes are not really like what we probably wouldn't even call them recipes. They're more like general ideas, but they at least lay out kind of what's going on with the dishes, at a very high level.
Cool.
So
should we start maybe stepping through them then?
Sure. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Like maybe, yeah. Like you can start providing the descriptions and then
yeah.
I can maybe get a little bit more context.
So for our first course was called Intuitive Antipasto. So
intuitive, what does that mean? I mean, I understand what the word means, but like
these are my notes from the quote formula that they provide in their cookbook.
Okay.
And so you take an orange and you hollow it out to form a little basket.
I'm with you so far.
And then you put...
You know what's really fun? Is if you like peel your mandarin oranges in a certain way, you can make them look like an elephant's face.
I do that regularly, actually, yeah. at the very least, at Christmas time when I'm eating mandarin oranges, is to like remove the peel in one piece. And
yeah.
I find the easiest way to do that is the elephant method.
Is with the elephant face
yeah.
method. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that should really be on this menu. Anyways, moving on.
Okay, so you hollow out an orange to form a little basket. And then in that basket, you put different kinds of salami and some butter and some pickled mushrooms and anchovies and little green peppers. Okay?
Okay.
So you have a little basket filled mm-hmm. with these items.
When you say basket, you just mean like a hollowed out half of an orange. We're not putting like a handle on it or anything.
Well, they don't specify in their formula, but in my mind, it has a little handle. I don't know.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. What All do right. you think? That'd be cute, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, potentially. Yeah, that would be cute. It would be really cute if you cut the orange, like cut like little diamonds out of it too, so that it looked like a woven basket.
Like a wicker basket, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you make this one day.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, and they say that, first of all, the intent is that this orange basket perfumes the elements within with the orange essence.
I feel like with the anchovies, it's sort of probably the other way around. But
yes, yeah. But most importantly, and I guess maybe what makes this intuitive antipasto is that in each of those little peppers that you've put in the basket, you hide little cards with printed messages on them, kind of like in the vein of a fortune cookie.
Okay. So when you said intuitive, well, initially I didn't really know what to think. And I understand the context of that word, or like I understand, I guess, the connotations of that word in a more modern kind of like a more modern definition of it. Mm-hmm. But like kind of what I was thinking in a like historical context, and now that you have like placed it in time for me, I'm kind of, it reminds me to some extent of like seance lingo or something.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think that's right. They suggest some of the messages that could be in the peppers, in their formula.
And some of them are like maybe messages from your dead relatives or something.
The one that I can reveal to you that doesn't give away too much of the context of the dinner. One of them is live dangerously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, let's move on to dish two. Is that a good thing? Or do you want more commentary from me on dish one?
No, only if you have something pressing. So dish two was called total rice with wine and beer.
Total rice.
But like, the word, our words total and rice smashed together. Total rice with wine
total
and
rice.
Beer. Yeah.
Okay.
My notes from the formula they gave it's boiled white rice plated as such, a hemisphere in the middle of the plate, and then a ring or crown encircling it. So both elements made of rice there, like a rice hemisphere in the center of the plate and then a rice ring around the hemisphere.
Okay.
At the table, over the hemisphere is poured a sauce of white wine thickened with cornstarch, and over the ring or crown is poured a sauce of beer, egg yolk, and Parmigiano.
Huh.
That's total rice with wine and beer.
Okay. Let me see if I have the picture correct in my head. So in the center of the plate, there's a hemisphere of white rice.
Yeah.
Like
a half dome.
I'm assuming molded by a bowl or something, right?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay. And then around that, there's a ring that they're calling the crown, or is the ring on
like a
top of the hemisphere
around it, like a circle of rice around the dome of rice.
Okay. And when you're, it seems intuitive to pour the wine sauce over the dome of rice. It seems somewhat unintuitive to pour the beer, egg yolk, and Parmesan sauce like you just pouring it in a ring around on top of the ring of rice.
That's how I interpret it.
Huh. Interesting. Cause I would think, you know, like you would like, I don't know. Yeah. I would think that you would be pouring something in between the ring and the hemisphere
like
or something.
A moat.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like a moat. Yeah. Like the ring is there to create like a moat or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
it says over the crown is poured a sauce of beer. Yeah.
Over the crown is poured a sauce of beer. Doesn't sound very interesting to me to eat this dish.
No, like I wonder.
I mean, it's not like I don't think that you could make it good. You know, like you can make really good rice.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that it's not really seasoned with anything seems a little weird. And then I mean, I'm assuming it's seasoned with salt at the very least, but like, right. You know.
Yeah, in the recipe, it just says boiled white rice. But although it does kind of like, in a way, like it kind of reminds me of risotto, like if you have wine and parm and stuff, but it right. doesn't sound as good as risotto. It sounds kind of gross. But.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not that I don't think that you could make it taste good, but mm-hmm. certainly within like within what they're laying out in the recipe, like I feel like you would have to make some alterations to, you know, like I feel like there may be some things that are just assumed that you would do to make it taste good, mm-hmm. you know, like some kind of seasoning and stuff like that. Right. But
even like white wine thickened with cornstarch, like there's delicious yeah. white wine sauces, but white wine on its own thickened with cornstarch is not very
cornstarch
tasty.
It's not going to be, yeah, like it's just not going to have a ton of flavor, you know, like if you're pouring it over white rice, mm-hmm. like, you know, I would feel like maybe you would have to make a reduction and then use some fresh wine or something if it, yeah. yeah, like I don't know.
And have stock okay. and stuff.
Yeah. Total rice with wine and beer.
Yeah.
Super weird. Okay.
Yep.
Moving on.
Maybe my favorite one of the of the menu. So the next course was our arrow food, comma, tactile, comma, with sounds and smells.
Arrow food.
Yeah. Arrow, like aeroplane, like A-E-R-O.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so from the right, the diner is served a plate with black olives, fennel hearts, and kumquats. Sounds nice.
Okay.
From the left, the diner is served a tactile rectangle. Now, this is basically like a piece of cardboard to which has been taped sandpaper, silk, and velvet.
Okay.
So, and the diner is instructed to, they're picking up the food on their right, the olives, fennel, and kumquats, with their right hand and bringing it straight to their mouth. Mm-hmm. While they are feeling the tactile the tactile rectangle with the fingertips of their left hand. Okay?
Oh man, this is right up my alley.
And this is this is in the recipe, in the formula, as they called it actually. So while the diner is eating the food and feeling the tactile rectangle, it says, waiters, spray the napes of the diner's necks with carnation perfume.
Oh my god.
It's not
done. What a nightmare.
And
oh my god, that's so upsetting, Alan.
And there's one more point in the formula.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It says simultaneously from the kitchen, the violent sound of an aeroplane motor and music by Bach.
Wow. Okay.
So the food is black olives, fennel hearts, and kumquats.
Fennel hearts and kumquats.
Yeah. That's the food.
And then the tactile rectangle is sandpaper, silk, and velvet.
Yeah. And then you got the and carnation.
The smells.
Yeah.
Are a horrible mist of carnation perfume on the back of your neck.
Yes.
While you're feeling up the sandpaper.
Yes. Yes.
And then you're bombarded with the sound of an airplane engine from the kitchen.
And Bach.
And Bach. But they don't.
The violent sound of an aeroplane motor and music by Bach.
Huh.
That's what it said.
And it just could be whatever Bach you happen to have.
They didn't
lying
specify
around.
Whether it was the cello suites or a partita. They didn't say.
Glenn Gould playing the piano.
Oh, maybe the Goldberg variations, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. Fascinating. That is, yeah, that sounds horrible. But
what's the most objectionable part of it to you?
It's definitely being sprayed on the back of the neck with something while I'm trying to eat. Like,
even if the aroma is,
especially like, I don't know. Okay, so like, you know, you're saying that like the menu the menu just says
arrow food
tactile
with sounds and smells. That's what the menu said.
So yeah, like I'm assuming then that the spray of the carnation scent on the back of your neck is going to be a surprise. Like,
I mean, it says, or do smells. They come to, it says smells right on the menu, so.
Oh well, yeah, but smells can come in. Like that, probably the olives and the kumquats are providing some smells also.
That's true.
You know, like probably plenty of other smells coming from the kitchen. I don't think if I saw smells on a menu, I mean, the first thing that springs to mind is like a lavender pillow or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
What's that from? Yeah. Yeah. What restaurant from, is that from?
I think from Alinea, right?
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I think it's from Alinea. Yeah. You're right. But yeah, like, if I wasn't expecting it and someone sprayed carnation perfume on the back of my neck while I was trying to eat a dinner, I'd probably jump out of my seat.
Right.
Like, yeah.
I guess
that sounds horrific.
Even, I don't know how much information the diners had before sitting down to this meal, but I do know that there was a lot of press about this restaurant before right. It opened.
I mean, I guess if the server came and said, if it's all right with you, the chef would like to have me spray some carnation perfume on the back of your neck while you feel the textures, then I might be like, okay, I guess, if it's part of the dish.
Yeah.
But if it was a surprise, I think I would, like, freak out.
Yes. It's
And I especially don't like carnations or how they smell.
Yeah.
They're awful.
I really like that that's the first, sorry, that you made the comparison between that and the carnation, or sorry, the lavender pillow. Because even though I agree with you that arrow food as a course sounds horrible, I do think that it suggests a lot of things that are actually done by very high
by modernist
end contemporary
yeah.
restaurants in yeah. in terms of the
I mean
smells
I have yeah I have to agree
sounds,
like
and, yeah
but like it reminds me like yeah I think yeah avant-garde is starting to seem more and more sort of like the correct description. Yes. You know, because like I think that there are a lot of modernist restaurants who feel like their meals have to be avant-garde, and I've read some like really bad reviews of restaurants where yeah like you know the whole goal of the meal is to you know make you feel out of place or surprise you in a way that's going to give you an emotional reaction, and it's not always positive or things like that, and
yeah.
I'm just always yeah. like I mean sure I guess you know like you're an artist and you're
right.
gonna make your art how you want to make it, and I guess it's going to make people feel a certain way, but doesn't sound not like it never sounds like something that I would really be all that interested in experiencing. But
yeah.
I am interested in eating at Alinea, mm-hmm. you know, because I kind of feel like at least with Grant Achatz and, you know, some of the other amazing chefs who are, you know, more actively there at Alinea developing the menu, like, I would feel like I'm in good hands. Like I would feel like there's
yeah,
a
totally.
Reason why there's a lavender pillow, you
yes.
know, and it goes with the dish, like the aroma goes with the dish or something. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. You can trust them. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe carnations and kumquats. Like maybe I'm just not aware that that's like a really amazing combination or something.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't really understand why olives, fennel hearts and kumquats are arrow foods. Do you have any insight as to why that might be?
I do. For now, I'll just say that this group of people loved to use arrow as a prefix for almost anything that they did. They were arrow poets and arrow sculptors and arrow painters.
Oh, interesting.
And, yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. That's not really ringing any bells for me, so that's interesting.
Okay.
Okay, so that was course three, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
Our next course was Ultra Virile.
Ultra Virile.
Which I like because it reminds me of ultra violence, like in A Clockwork Orange.
A Clockwork Orange, yeah.
And this it's really a mess. And so the note that I took from the formula was, to put it succinctly, this is a dish of calf's tongue, prawns, lobster, green zabaglione, hard-boiled egg, cock's comb, lemon, grape, truffle, and lobster coral. Should I say that again?
Whoa.
They gave fairly precise or relatively precise information on how these items should be put on the plate.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, it was calf's tongue, prawns, lobster, green zabaglione, hard-boiled egg, cock's comb, lemon, grape, truffle, and lobster coral.
Okay.
Kind of like a surf and turf there.
Yeah. Yeah, surf and turf and poultry.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I would like for you to describe to me how this stuff is supposed to be put on the plate.
Sure.
But just one question first. Is there like any indication of how the green zabaglione is like colored?
No, that's a good question. Because throughout their cookbook, there are multiple uses of red zabaglione and green zabaglione. And I assumed the red one had red wine in it, like a beurre rouge.
Right.
And I don't know about the green one, although they do make other references to liquefied spinach. So I would, it might just be something as simple as that. So
maybe they're just coloring it with, yeah. Okay.
I can read you the full, it's not that long, but I can read you the directions for Ultra Virile.
Okay, let's do it.
So on a rectangular plate, put some thin slices of calf's tongue, boiled and cut lengthwise. Mm-hmm. On top of these, arrange lengthwise along the axis of the plate, two parallel rows of spit roasted prawns.
Okay.
Between these two rows, place the body of a lobster, previously boned and shelled, covered in green zabaglione. So you've got calf's tongue, roasted prawns, a whole lobster covered in green sauce. Okay.
But the lobster has been shelled. So probably the tail meat is going in between the prawns, and then you have the claws like presented up above that, but already out of the shells, I'm assuming.
Plausible.
About
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the tail end of the lobster, place three halves of hard-boiled egg cut lengthwise so that the yellow rests on the slices of tongue.
Okay.
The front part, however, is crowned with six cock's combs laid out like sectors of a circle. While completing the garnish are two rows of little cylinders composed of a little wheel of lemon, slices of grape, and a slice of truffle sprinkled with lobster coral.
Where on the plate is that meant to go? Sorry.
The front part of the lobster is crowned with the six cock's combs laid out sector of a circle. So like I picture that as like radially away from the front of the lobster.
Oh, okay. It's not like a dome that looks like it's coming off or like, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, I think I understand what you mean. Like radially, like
kind of projecting from
one
front.
Claw over to like the other claw, kind of.
Yeah, that's what I'm picturing, but the language is not super precise.
Okay.
And then all it says is completing the garnish are two rows of little cylinders composed of a little wheel of lemon, slices of grape, and a slice of truffle sprinkled with lobster coral. So you have little cylinders that are lemon wheels, sliced grapes, sliced truffles, lobster coral. And there's two rows of these cylinders, but it doesn't really specify how they're positioned.
How many cylinders or where the rows are or how you make cylinders out of lemon wheels.
Grapes, truffles, slices of truffle. Lobster coral,
I am assuming you're rolling them. Yeah, you're rolling them. You're rolling the lemon wheels.
I was picturing stacking because everything's cut into rounds and then you stack them, but yours makes sense too.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, stacks also make sense. Mm-hmm. If you cut everything into little circles and then you stack them, you would wind up with cylinders. Yeah. Okay. Ultra virile.
Yeah. Not just virile.
Ultra virile. Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to pretend to understand that one.
Flavor wise, how could it be bad?
No. I mean,
it's just too much stuff. It's just too many elements.
Yeah. I can picture the lemon kind of being like, well, I don't know. Lemon and truffle is really nice, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably, yeah. It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Gross. And I don't know if the implication is that it's supposed to be like an aphrodisiac or something, presumably, right? With a name like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But like, when you said ultra virile, I was like, oh, okay, maybe this is the aphrodisiac course. And then I was like, what's a stereotypical aphrodisiac? And then I was like, oh, definitely there's going to be like some oysters on this dish or something. But I was wrong.
I don't think there's oysters on this menu, but we'll see here.
Okay.
Okay. So the next course is just called sculpted meat.
Right.
And it's another weird one. Okay, so the sculpted meat itself, and this is my paraphrase of the formula. The sculpted meat itself is a large cylinder of minced veal that has been stuffed with 11 kinds of vegetable and crowned with a thick layer of honey.
Okay.
So it's a vertical cylinder of minced veal stuffed with vegetables and topped with honey.
Okay.
And then it says, this cylinder is supported by a sausage ring, which rests on 3 golden spheres of chicken meat.
What?
So from the bottom up, we on the very bottom, we have 3 golden spheres of chicken meat. That's as precise as they get. That's what they tell you.
They have a name for that, Alan. It's called meatballs.
I thought it was nugs.
Nugs. Okay, so you make some chicken meatballs and you cover them with gold leaf?
I guess. Oh, maybe. I assumed that it was just like breaded and fried, but
I don't know. Yeah, I suppose that's possible. Okay.
Golden spheres. Yeah. And then on top of the 3 golden spheres of chicken meat, there's a sausage ring.
A sausage ring. So in a casing?
I mean, I think so. Yeah.
Like in a small case, like in a lamb casing or something? So
I'm thinking this is like more more monolithic. Like it's like it's big, like it's carved table side and it's a big cylinder of.
Oh, okay. It's not, there's not one of these on every plate or.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's how I was picturing it. Like this is like a showpiece kind of.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. That kind of makes sense. Yeah. It's a lot of honey, but anyways.
Yeah.
It doesn't say what the 10 kinds of vegetables are.
Shale, it's 11 kinds. No, it doesn't. Not in the formula.
Okay.
So 3 balls of golden chicken meat on the bottom and then a sausage ring on top of that.
A ring of sausage.
And then our large cylinder of minced veal stuffed with vegetables crowned
so
with honey.
So is the large cylinder of minced veal, is it cooked or raw? Like
I assumed cooked
because I assumed raw.
Oh really?
So I don't know, I like it would structurally, I don't know how you would do that. Mm-hmm. But so structurally maybe it would have to be cooked, but then it would kind of almost be like sausage if it was going to be able to stand up like a cylinder.
That's
I don't
true
know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Veal, vegetables, honey, sausage, chicken, 3 kinds of ground
chicken.
Meat.
Gold.
Golden, yes. Spherical. Super phallic, right? Like ridiculously phallic. Am I crazy? Am I
ridiculously
reading
into this? Phallic. I mean, yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
Okay.
The next course was called Italian Sea. sea, like ocean. On a rectangular plate, a precise pattern of stripes is made, alternating red and green. The red is fresh tomato sauce, and the green is that liquidized spinach that I mentioned.
Spinach, yeah. Okay.
So onto this striped plane are placed vertically skewers that have boiled fish, banana slices, cherry, and dried fig.
Huh. Okay.
So stripes of sauce alternating red and green, but it says it should be like very precise and geometric. And then
like across the plate or lengthwise on the plate?
It doesn't specify, but I'm picturing like a flag, like the American flag, but I don't know.
Or like the
it could
Italian
be like the Italian flag.
Yeah.
Alan?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So a tomato and spinach are the sauces, and then the skewers that are vertical are boiled fish, doesn't specify.
Boiled fish.
Sliced banana, cherry, and dried fig.
Huh. Interesting. All right. Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with that. It doesn't sound very Italian to me. I'm pretty sure you can't grow bananas in Italy. Anyways.
Doesn't sound, I don't know. Like, could that possibly taste good? I don't know. It's too much.
I don't know.
Too much.
Like, fish and, like, I don't, yeah. I think that there's probably, well, like, for instance, there's a ton of fish and plantain dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in places where plantains are available. So, you know, like, it's not like crazy, but then the addition of the cherries makes it a little weird.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then the dried figs, I guess, like, what is that bringing? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It doesn't sound great, honestly.
No, it doesn't. And then we're on to our steel chicken. So the chicken is cooked in two stages. First, it's a whole chicken and it's boiled.
Okay.
And then I'm just going to quote from the book here. Okay. So after the chicken is boiled, quote, "A capacious cavity is dug out of the shoulder of the bird, within which one places a handful of little ball bearings made of mild steel."
What?
Yes. "Onto the rear part of the bird, one sews in three slices of raw coxcomb. It's then roasted in the oven for 10 minutes. And then, quote, "when the flesh has fully absorbed the flavor of the mild steel balls, the chicken is served with a garnish of whipped cream." End quote.
Oh, okay.
So it's chicken that's been boiled, and then they put steel ball bearings and coxcomb into the bird and then roast it.
And then roast it.
And then serve it with whipped cream.
So when they boil it, though, because it said into the rare part, so like it's not fully cooked after it's boiled?
Sorry, onto the rear part.
Oh, onto the rear part. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
So, and this, the actual anatomy, the description of the anatomy makes no sense to me. So after the chicken is boiled, a capacious cavity is dug out of the shoulder of the bird. That I can't picture that at all. Do they mean like into the meat of the shoulder, like the back?
Yeah, I assume you like in the back where the wings are.
But like, why would you do it there?
I don't know. Like, why? Like, basically, the cavity goes like all the way from the rear part of the bird all the way. Basically, you could just put them in through the cavity. So I don't really understand. But I guess if you're like, I mean, maybe under the breast so that it's against the bone, but under the breast, right, or something, so that it make contact with the breast meat,
right,
or something. Yeah.
And then onto the,
whereas if you just put them in the cavity, they may not really be making much contact with the breast meat or something.
Right. So you think that when they say, like, the capacious cavity dug out of the shoulder of the bird takes you to the chicken breast? Is that what
I mean,
you mean,
like, or? that doesn't really make sense. Like, if you're digging into the shoulder, like, it basically means that you're placing them in the cavity, but
yeah.
I don't know, maybe that's what they mean. I don't know.
I guess it could be the front the front part of the shoulder, like by the
shoulder,
wishbone, and stuff. Maybe that would make more
sense.
Yeah,
exactly.
To me, if your goal is to infuse the meat with steel. And then, yeah.
Which sounds like a really not, this just sounds like a counterintuitive goal. Like,
yeah.
Anyways.
And then, yeah, onto the rear part of the bird, one sews in three slices of raw coxcomb. And I don't know what the rear part of the bird is.
Means.
But...
or why you would sew them in. Oh, I guess. Oh, so maybe into the rear cavity and then you sew the cavity closed. Maybe. Right. That's like a reason. That's
maybe,
like
yeah.
a reasonably
be, yeah.
common stuffing technique.
Right.
Yeah.
But why you. Yeah, I don't know. Why, like, why you would just toss the coxcombs into the cavity instead of I don't know.
Also, I have an admission to make. I've never eaten coxcomb. Have you?
No, I was thinking about it though as I was preparing this. I have, maybe as we've discussed before, like ample access to chicken parts. But the coxcombs on the birds that we've harvested are so small that we never, I thought about it, but I never reserved any or prepared any, just because the breeds that we were working with, like they're not even a quarter inch tall. I didn't think it would.
So it just doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't even be like a little spoonful.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I haven't tasted them.
Yeah. I'm curious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then is there a description of how it's plated or?
No. No.
And what was the other name for it?
Chicken fiat? Like all one word.
Chicken fiat.
F-I-A-T at the end of the word chicken. And I don't know. I tried to find out if that, like I searched if fiat was like the Italian word for steel, but it's not. It's ferro. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what fiat means, but. As near as
okay.
I can tell.
Yeah, I don't really know what fiat means either. I don't.
Means car.
Super good context for that word. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that the menu said chicken fiat and that it's often just described as steel chicken, but I'm not 100%
steel
sure.
Chicken. Yeah. Okay. That's a weird one.
Yeah. And then next we have equator and North Pole. It's written as equator plus North Pole.
Okay.
And quote, an equatorial sea, unquote, of poached egg yolks with pepper, salt, and lemon. And then in the center of the plate, there's a cone of stiffly whipped and solidified egg whites dotted with orange segments, like succulent, this is a quote, like succulent pieces of the sun.
Okay.
Okay, sorry, just to step back here. So there's a like this, what they call an equatorial sea. So like around the entire perimeter of the plate is the poached egg yolks with pepper, salt, and lemon. And then in the
poached egg yolks. So poached hard and then know. Like broken up, grated or something, or like, yeah,
it's
okay.
left. It's left to our imagination at this point.
Like poached the yolk of poached eggs, maybe. So,
oh,
so it's soft.
That would be better.
Potentially.
That would be better. I think.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I don't know.
Let's pretend that's what
case.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. And then so in the center, a cone of stiffly whipped egg whites. Dotted with orange segments like succulent pieces of the sun.
Pieces of the sun. Okay.
The peak of the cone, this is all a quote, the peak of the cone is bombarded by bits of black truffle shaped to look like black aeroplanes trying to conquer the zenith or zenith.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
So egg yolk sea. Egg white mountain, succulent pieces of the sun on the mountain, and then black truffle cut out to look like airplanes around the summit of the egg whites. That's equator and North Pole. Yeah.
Disturbing? I don't know.
The ingredients
are
disturbing.
Eggs and truffles go good together.
That's true. And oranges?
I mean, I often have orange juice at breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
So, maybe. Just, like, when we moved on to this dish,
mm-hmm.
I had kind of forgotten about in the steel chicken dish that it's served with whipped cream.
Yes. Yeah.
And then when you started talking about the meringue tower in the...
There was so much going
What's
on.
What's this
in,
one called?
Equator and North Pole.
Oh, Equator and North Pole. Yeah, when you started talking about the meringue tower, I was like, wait, that chicken was served with whipped cream? What?
It's bad, like, when there's something so strange about a chicken dish that you don't even notice that it's served
you
with
just
whipped cream.
Block it out. Exactly. My mind just could not deal with that. And it was just like, as soon as you said it, it was just gone. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I got it. Equator and North Pole makes perfect sense. Equatorial ocean of delicious, hot
egg yolks.
Soft egg yolk. Okay. I'm not getting less confused as we move through this. That's for sure.
The next one is Elasticake.
Oh yeah.
Great name. I have to say the description does not do justice to
make
the
it
name.
Sound yeah. good. That's too bad.
This is a straight quote. Fill a ball of puff pastry with some red zabaglione and insert a stick 3 centimeters of licorice. Close the top part of the ball with half a prune. End quote. So it's a ball of puff pastry
with a hole cut in the top.
It's a ball of puff pastry with a hole cut in the yeah. top. Some red zabaglione, which I interpret to mean red wine zabaglione, but I don't actually
yeah.
know.
Which I think is a reasonable interpretation.
A piece of licorice.
Although it could be tomato.
That's true, yeah. a piece of licorice, and then the ball is closed up with half of a prune. Puff pastry, maybe red wine sauce, licorice, and prune.
When they say licorice, clearly they're talking about black licorice. There probably was no red licorice.
I think that's right, yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, to me, it doesn't sound like it would be that bad. It just sounds random and not...
And doesn't really have anything to do with cake.
Yeah.
So that's sad.
That's the biggest disappointment. Like, to me, like that cake that you described that's cooked to order in a microwave, like that could somehow be Elasticake.
Yeah. Or if you, yeah, exactly. If you could cook it with like a kind or if you could make like sort of a fluffy cake out of like mochi flour.
Yeah.
So it was like very, you know, like very spongy springy. And very sticky and springy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm.
That would be way
elastic cake. If you had like nice, soft, supple cake on the outside and like the core was like mochi or something, elastic cake.
Yeah, that sounds great. But,
yeah.
I'm going to write that down.
Okay, good.
Anyways. And then our last course is Network in the Sky.
Network in the Sky.
Another great name. So the most important, obviously, like there's ingredients and flavors, but like the most important thing is the presentation, and that's why it's called Network in the Sky. So
okay,
to give you a general idea first, it's like a stack of cylinders and they get smaller as they get higher. It's like a kind of like okay. round ziggurat kind of formation, but it has a large sail or wing like projecting out of the side of it.
Okay.
So like this kind of construction is why it's called Network in the Sky. I think there's something like aerial about it.
Yeah.
So of those cylinders, the base one is a disc that's cherry flavored caramel.
Okay.
And then the largest cylinder on top of that is puff pastry stuffed with tamarind pulp and covered with chocolate. Yum.
Okay.
The next slightly smaller one is built of stacked meringues covered with a mandarin fondant.
Okay.
The next smaller one on top of that is whipped cream with tamarind pulp and pistachio. And then that that wing projecting from this side is made of mandarin flavored caramel. And the entire thing,
like hard caramel, I assume.
I think so, yeah.
So that it's stable.
Yes. And then the whole thing is garnished with threads of green spun sugar.
Oh, okay.
So
so then the green spun sugar is probably makes like kind of like a net.
Yeah, or like a cloud kind of appearance, yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
Okay. Sounds fancy looking.
Yeah.
I'm pretty into most of the components.
Yeah, like I think cherry and tamarind is a great combo. Yeah,
and chocolate and tamarind I think could be really good too, like in an interesting way. And then you got like the mandarin caramel and the cherry caramel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Still like kind of a little bit convoluted flavor-wise, but I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of like candy, depending on how like the textures are, like it might kind of be a pain in the rear to eat.
Yeah.
Well, that one sounds interesting. Okay, well, it's got to be American. Right?
If you think that it's American, how do you account for all of the references to or allusions to Italy and Italian cuisine? Because we started with an antipasto.
Yeah.
We have rice and wine. We've got...
Just because, like, because Italian food is very popular in America. Mm-hmm. Like that's how I account for that.
Mm-hmm. So you see it being served like in New York or New Jersey kind of places or Connecticut?
Yeah, like in New York. I don't know. I'm thinking, like some kind of like, I mean, some type of like avant-garde, like, artists collective or something. Mm-hmm. And it's probably like New York is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
How far off am I?
Like geographically?
Let's start with that.
It's not from New York or America or North America.
Okay.
It's straight up from Italy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Italy, I don't know a whole lot about like Italian history, and I don't know too much about like pre-World War II Italy. So a lot of airplane stuff in there. I'm not quite sure. Clearly that was like the like a big deal technologically at the time. Mm-hmm. Would be airplanes, right? Like mm-hmm. flying was invented not too long before that, right? Like a couple of decades.
Yeah, that's right. I think.
Yeah.
And certainly like in terms of military, like obviously there were planes in the First World War, but they didn't play nearly the same role.
But they were like biplanes and stuff, right?
Yeah, like yes, exactly. Yeah. Definitely didn't play nearly the same role they did in the Second World War.
This is kind of off track and we don't have to go down this rabbit hole too far, but have you seen Porco Rosso?
No. What's that?
It is a Studio Ghibli movie that I believe is directed by Hayao Miyazaki.
Yeah.
And it's like very Italian, I believe. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah, like I think it's mostly it's like basically a movie about a pilot who's like a dogfighter and there are like sky pirates. He's kind of like going up against these sky pirates who are like harassing this like Italian coastline. Mm-hmm. And like, I think most of it is set in Italy and it's all about like Italian aeronautical history and stuff.
Huh.
Yeah. It's great. It's really good. It's a really fun watch. But yeah, I'm sure Cora would love it.
Do you want to learn what dogfighting is?
There's also a romance in it.
Oh, really? But so it's obviously kind of a weird romance. Very fantastic. It's not like, I mean, if there's sky pirates.
Well, yeah, the main character is a pig man.
Oh,
so,
I see.
Yeah, it's, yeah. And there's no real explanation for that.
Right.
And nobody else in the movie is an animal person.
Yeah.
Everyone else is just humans. I don't know.
That sounds like kind of what that studio does, though, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. It's a very Miyazaki situation. Anyways, this is to me right now in my brain, this is Porco Rosso menu.
This is the menu they ate in the movie. Even though
there's very little pork on it.
Yeah, that's true. There's salami a couple times, but
right,
yeah,
and sausage, like a ring of sausage, which I'm assuming would be like a pork sausage. Yeah. But yeah,
can I tell you about it?
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna get too far with me guessing contexts now. I was clearly like pretty off base, so yeah, you might as well just come out with it.
Like I said, this was the opening menu for a restaurant that opened in March of 1931. It opened in Milan, Italy, and it was called the Holy Palate. That was the name of the restaurant, the Holy Palate.
Okay.
And it was the brainchild of...
I'm assuming that that's translated from Italian?
Yeah, that's right. Or, yes, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Yeah. As would all of these dish...
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
In Italian, it's the Taverna del Sato Palato. There you go.
Okay. Sato Palato.
It was the brainchild of an Italian artist named Filippo Marinetti.
Okay.
And he was the founder of an artistic movement called Futurism. Which made me very excited when you said it's kind of a futurist menu.
Right.
But yeah, in 1909, he founded this art movement called Futurism that was very radical and like a wholesale rejection of the past.
Okay.
And an attempt to fully embrace the future and especially the new technologies of the 20th century.
Right.
So like you mentioned the many aeronautical references and the aero food and the network in the sky and stuff, they were absolutely mm-hmm. obsessed with, aviation, cars, trains, industrialization, radio, television, like all of yeah. that. And yeah,
well, television wasn't really a thing, I don't think yet.
I don't know. Like, I don't know about 1931. Like, Marinetti lived until 1944, so I assume that he would have had some exposure to TV at some point, or at least,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's right around there. Some of the very first TV broadcasts were like in the early 30s, I think. But yeah.
So it's interesting because Marinetti, he was actually like very well known, and like you said, this. Even though futurism itself isn't very mainstream or very, very well known or broadly known now, it was hugely influential mm-hmm. in later things like the avant-garde movement. But interestingly, even though Marinetti was first known as a poet, and he did all kinds of different media, like painting and sculpture and all that, but he was really interested in applying his futurist principles to food and to, like, no joke, changing how everyone, but especially Italians, ate. And so he opened this restaurant. He wasn't the owner of it, but he, like I said, it was kind of his brainchild. And he wrote this, what's called the Futurist Cookbook. That contains all of these so-called formulas for the food. The way that he applied the futurist principles to food were, first of all, that it needs to be new, just like he thought that it would be lazy and passéist to, like, you know, make paintings of stories from the Bible or from Greek and Roman
or
mythology. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's got to be new and looking towards the technological future. He thought the same thing about food, And so like,
right.
That's why there's...
And so he just assumed that in the future, people would want to eat pieces of steel or things that tasted like pieces of steel because steel's like a new hot material.
Well, okay. So what he actually thought is that in the future and the not so distant future for him, that everyone would get their basic nourishment and like caloric intake from pills.
Right.
And that food and eating would become basically an artistic form. Like you do it to be like for it to be evocative and thought provoking and stimulating and stuff like that.
Right.
And so all of his food is very light. Like it's not heavy and caloric. It's like, well, I don't know about the sculpted meat. That sounds pretty heavy to me. But,
yeah, it sounds pretty intense.
But it needed to be, it couldn't rely on tradition and nostalgia, which is crazy because that's like one of the most important things about food for for most people and certainly for you and me. But to give you an example of how seriously he took that concept, he published and did a series of lectures talking about how pasta needs to be eradicated from Italian culture.
Oh my God. lock them up.
When he announced the foundation of modernist cuisine, he said, our main goal is to eradicate pasta because it makes people lethargic and, pessimistic and nostalgic and all of these traits that he thought were just death. To progress and all that. And he got quotes from doctors and things like that saying that pasta was bad for you.
My God.
And, so yeah, you're right. That was obviously a very polarizing issue in Italy. And like
a good way to draw attention to yourself yes. is to say really heretical things about the culture that you exist in, I guess.
Totally, yeah.
It's sort of like, I don't know. It's like shock art or something.
Oh yeah,
it's like Marilyn
absolutely.
Manson or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah, absolutely. That's what it was. I guess I don't have a very clear idea, but this sounds like a very fringe kind of thing. But my understanding is that he was actually extremely well known in Italy before and after the First World War. Even before the First World War.
Crazy.
And through the fascist era. And like I said, he died during the Second World War, but,
right.
So yeah, no pasta. But the other really important kind of tenets of futurist cuisine was that it needs to like stimulate as many of the senses as possible. Yeah. Which is why you have your aero food tactile with sounds and smells. But one,
which is also kind of a tenet of like modernist cuisine as well.
Totally.
You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, it needs to be affecting all of your senses, or it doesn't need to be necessarily, but it's like important to consider
yes.
all of your senses, yeah. you know, like,
and
yeah.
You brought up the great example of the aroma with the lavender pillow. There's also some, I couldn't think of very many, but there's definitely some examples of the audio.
For sure. And the textural thing too.
Yeah,
for sure. Like I've seen that. I've seen things like that in, yeah, like, quote unquote modernist restaurants where like something is brought to the table purely for touch, you know,
like mean, and you don't mean like your mouth feel, you mean like touching it with your hands.
Yeah. Touching it with
oh,
your
is
hands
that right?
or like,
can you think of the specific example?
No, I can't spot, not off the top of my head, but yeah, I've definitely heard of stuff like that or mm-hmm. like, you know, something that you put on your head or, you know, or something,
right?
You know,
yeah,
like, yeah.
the like sound one that I only half remembered. Actually, I think it's from the Fat Duck Cookbook. There's some course that Heston Blumenthal served where you were given an iPod.
Oh yeah, you put on earbuds.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And it amplifies the sound of your the crunching sounds from within your mouth. And apparently,
oh, right. oh, yeah.
it like makes the food seem
very crunchy.
Yeah.
And I remember on his TV show, he did a whole thing about that.
Oh, is
like,
that right? Yeah.
He said like a huge part of the sensation of crunch
is sound,
is the auditory part of it, and that you can like cheat and make things seem crunchy by having like an auditory crunch.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
So I, like I said before, I agree with you that the Aero food course sounds absolutely terrible, but it's funny that it really has a lot of the same kind of ideas and sentiment behind it as some lauded modernist stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But okay, so to carry on with the like multi-sensory idea, and just to make you hate all of this food all the more, they did not use cutlery for any of the food.
Yeah.
It was all to be picked up with the fingers and brought to the mouth directly. No forks, no knives, no spoons. Yeah.
Hopefully they'll replace your napkin very often.
With there was, I can't think of any off the top. Oh, actually, yeah. There's obviously lots of sexual innuendo, like we mentioned it with the sculpted meat, but there was other even more obvious, just kind of sexual ways that things were plated. That was like one of the kind of hallmarks of the food. And they do say that the formulas are intentionally vague because like you're an artist, and as you're creating this, you have to take inspiration from your groaning, follow any kind of intuition.
Well, I mean, I guess it's good that they say that so that, you know, like if you feel like you need to add some flavor to boiled rice and unfortified wine sauce, that you can take some liberties there to make it taste good. I mean,
That's the context of this menu, is that it's a wholesale, it's not just art, but it's like an ideology. Like it's like a, supposed to portray the kind of manifesto of futurism.
Wow. That's really interesting. So do you have any information about like how long the restaurant was open for, or is there any information about like how it was received, or any like
the Futurist Cookbook is about as loose a cookbook as you can get. And so besides these formulas that I've been referring to, it starts with like the manifesto of futurist cooking, and it contains like a lot of the writing that was happening in Italian papers about futurism and about the restaurant, and it's all hype. It's
so the cookbook was written after the restaurant opened, so there's
around the same within the same few years. It's pretty hilarious actually, like the amount of hype that's being put into it, but I assume that it's like from tabloids who are sympathetic to this cause. And the other part of the story, and I guess of the way that it's portrayed in media at the time and in the cookbook, is that this is fascist Italy. And this artist, Marinetti, I don't mean in a rhetorical way, I mean in a very literal way, he was a fascist. He knew Mussolini, and he actually was one of the two authors of the Fascist Manifesto. Wrote the words to the Fascist Manifesto. And so everything that he writes has this kind of like sensational, like it's the language that you expect from a political manifesto like that. So anyways, from the way that it's portrayed in the book, just to follow through on that, like, so he was very much in support of war, and he was racist and misogynist, and he's a very complicated person, and there's a lot of disgusting things about futurism and what it thought about, especially about violence. Actually, it can be pretty disturbing. But anyways, yeah, he was a full supporter of the fascist party in Italy. Yeah, so the way that it's colored in the book is you have to keep all of that in mind, that they're propagandists,
Right, exactly. Yeah. Propagandists for their futurist cause or whatever.
Yeah.
Man, that's nuts. I think it really reminds me, like, just the descriptions of the dishes and like it just going through it, it really reminds me of a review, a restaurant review that I read fairly recently.
Oh, is that right?
About, yeah, I think it's an Italian modernist restaurant. Mm-hmm. But it was like a really bad dining experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the review was hilarious. I will try to dig it up. If I can find it, I will definitely put it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So that people can read it. But like, I'll send it to you and we should like we should do a segment of follow-up talking about that restaurant review, because it just like, it really, I don't know. I feel like it really jives with, I'm sure, you know, a lot of the sentiment of people who would have eaten at this restaurant, you
right,
know, like,
yeah,
just like, you know, like the food is just there to like disturb you and
yes,
really make you have a bad time.
Yes.
And, yeah.
But you get the,
so yeah, if I can dig it up, I'll send it to you and then we can talk about it on the next episode for sure.
And that was a contemporary Italian restaurant, you think? Like,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like within the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have that to look forward to. wow, Alan, that was great. I really hope that you have another one of those in you.
There's always some in the works, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. That's great. That one was fascinating.
It's just so weird. And like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, steel chicken and whipped cream. I'm just like...
But you see how that plays into their, like, their obsession,
yeah, I get it
with
now,
like industrialism and like...
But, okay, so here's the thing though.
Violence and...
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah. He's very anti-tradition and, you know, like pasta's off the menu and he's anti-nostalgia. But, you know, like somehow there's still a lot of wine on the menu.
Yeah.
Isn't that like
a
historical
and...
Italian feel good nostalgic thing that, you know, like I guess he just wasn't willing to give up for his
right,
grand futuristic vision or whatever, you know, like
I think, and that's probably
seems pretty ridiculous.
I haven't read anything like this, but it seems like the kind of thing that within the sect of futurism, there's probably people who are like, even Marinetti's passeist, like he's using wine. Well, I'm not using
exactly,
wine. I'm using, you know, mercury or something.
Motor oil.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.